On this episode of Skeptico, Michael Marshall and members of the Righteous Indignation podcast express their doubts about psychic medium experiments.
If this study were true, and I'm going to leave apart the previous issues that I've had with it and give it the benefit of the doubt for a moment and say, in perfectly blinded conditions, 13 out of 16 people chose the reading that was intended for them, the 16 people here. If I wrote A and B on two pieces of paper and put them in envelopes and asked 16 people to choose the A without showing them, if 13 people were able to choose the A, I wouldn't say that those people were psychic. I would just say we need a larger group.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I'm going to publish an interview that's long overdue. I did an interview several months ago with the folks at the Righteous Indignation podcast and website over in the UK, and they were really nice enough to do an interview with me prior to that back in January, and I'll provide a link to that in the notes. And then we did a follow-up interview a few months ago, but I just haven't gotten around to publishing it because, as you know, in listening to the show, we've kind of gone off in a couple of different topics, and one led to another, and I just could never kind of find a time to jam it in there, and I apologize for that, but here it is. It's a pretty long discussion. It has a range of different topics we talk about, but one thing that comes up that people have asked me about is the psychic medium research, and we talk quite a bit about it because we had originally planned to do another collaborative project like I had originally proposed with the folks at the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and Dr. Stephen Novella. Well, I said with the folks at Righteous Indignation here, hey, let's try and do the same thing. But, you know, it again hasn't happened. And I think in this dialogue, you'll see some of the reasons that make that problematic. I mean, deciding exactly on the protocols, even for a demonstration like this, it's just difficult. And at the end of the day, you really got to sit back and say, what are we really accomplishing doing something like this? How are we really going to reveal anything to anyone? And that's why if you go back and listen to Skeptico and you want to know where I went with the medium experiment stuff, it really is encapsulated in show number 75 with Marilyn Hughes, where we did quite an extensive medium reading and experiment over a course of a couple shows that is really how I want to go if we do this stuff in the future, because it affects people's lives. I mean, medium readings are really are important. If they're real, and I think they're real, they affect people deeply, and they're not to be taken lightly. But the discussion we have of it here is, I think, very, very revealing. We also talk about the Global Consciousness Project and have some interesting thoughts on that. And if you go back and listen to the first interview I did with the Righteous Indignation folks, you'll see the kind of follow-on story arc there. Anyways, it's a long interview, and I've made it even longer with this introduction. So let's get right to it. I'm joined today by the folks from Righteous Indignation, a podcast originating out of Manchester, UK, that has a very, very interesting take on the supernatural and psychic investigations. Now, they were nice enough to have me on their podcast a few weeks ago, and we generated a really interesting dialogue, I thought. And one of the things that we decided to do was to have a follow-up to that. And so the first thing I'd like to do before I have Tristan and Marsh and Gavin introduce themselves is to really commend them on being willing to engage in this give and take, and particularly in this follow-on discussion, because I've found that that's where the discussion really gets interesting, when both sides get past their talking points of skeptical talking points or believer talking points and really get down to the issues. So I'm really looking forward to this follow-on discussion. And with that, I was hoping maybe each of you could do a very brief introduction, tell us a little bit about some of the points I might have left out of Righteous Indignation, and a little bit about your background as well. Do you want to start off, Tristan?
Yeah, that's fine. It's probably best just to introduce myself, first of all. I'm Tristan Swell, and I'm an elementary teacher by day. The podcast was my idea, and I'm a former paranormal investigator who, when I went into it, I sat on the fence, and now I've come out of it very, very skeptical indeed.
Yeah, I'm Michael Marshall. I co-run the Merseyside Skeptic Society, and I tend to take a look at a bit of all sorts, really. I'm interested very heavily in psychics, and I also just kind of just finished, or just in the middle of running an international campaign looking at homeopathy, actually, which is getting a lot of media attention. So I kind of have my fingers in a lot of pies, I guess.
Great. Thanks, Marsh. And Gavin?
I'm Gavin. I'm pretty new to all this. I run the Greater Manchester Skeptics, and I'm interested in all sorts of bits and bobs related to the paranormal and whatnot. And I'm just finding my feet, bit of a layman in this.
Okay, fair enough. And Tristan, was I correct? Is the podcast originate out of Manchester, or are you guys kind of spread out over the UK and just connect on Skype?
We're Skype people. Gav's in Manchester. I'm in a town called Cheltenham, and Marsh is in Liverpool.
Yeah, I'm in Beatle country.
Great.
The Beatles.
So, okay, here's what I thought was interesting about our last discussion. We kind of touched on a lot of different topics. We talked about psychic medium communication. We talked a little bit about psychic detectives. We talked about global consciousness. And the discussion was kind of freewheeling and very interesting, but it left a lot of loose ends and follow-up. So I almost guess I'd invite you guys to start with telling me where we might jump back into the discussion and which one of those points we want to pick up on.
I think the psychic testing would probably be a good one to start with, if that's okay.
Well, I think it'd be a great to start with. And I guess the way I'd start with that is, in looking over the comments that were posted on your website after our last talk, one of the comments you made, Tristan, was, if you look at the evidence for Psi, then it's highly debatable at best unless you take out the work of Gary Schwartz and Julie Bischel. And here's the part I want to focus on, whose protocols are dubious at best. Now, I like that statement because it's a scientific statement. I mean, you are making a scientific claim. You're saying, I've read the research and the protocols are dubious at best. Now, I don't agree with you, but that's certainly the kind of dialogue I want to have today. What leads you to make that claim that their protocols are dubious at best?
Well, first of all, let me correct you, Alex. I'm not the one making the scientific claim. It's Bischel and Schwartz are the ones making the claim.
Absolutely, absolutely not true. We have to acknowledge going in that when someone objects to research, they are making an equal scientific claim. Your claim is that their protocols are dubious. So we can handle their claim separately, but you are making a claim. I just had to interject that. I think that's an important point.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair.
You are not freed from scrutiny because you are commenting on someone else's research.
And I'm not suggesting I am, Alex.
I'll let you continue.
If you look at their scoring system, okay, we've got the highest reading. We've got number 6, an excellent reading, including strong aspects of communication with essentially no incorrect information. And we go all the way down the list to 0, and we have no correct information or communication. And let's have a look at their mean score, which from their intended category is about 3.5. Okay, and we look at the range, which goes from about 4.5 down to 2.5. And the range is roughly coincide with that of the control group, which goes from about 1.25 up to 2.5. So let's look at the scores, the meanings from 2, 3, and 4. If we got 2, some correct information, but not enough to suggest beyond chance that communication occurred. 3, mixture of correct and incorrect information, but enough correct information to indicate that communication with the deceased occurred. And 4, good reading with some incorrect information. The issue I have with this is, where do we draw the line there? What constitutes communication with the dead? How do they decide what is some correct information? And how do they differentiate, mainly between 2 and 3, what is a mixture of correct and incorrect information?
Okay, well, let's back up a minute. You have a lot of information there, but let's back up and kind of bring people in to what we're talking about, just in case they're not up to speed. So Julie Bischel is this researcher who is currently at an independent organization called the Winbridge Institute, and she looks at psychic medium communication. Now, she was formerly a colleague of Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona, who was quite famous for doing this kind of research. Now, so with that as a background, the first thing that I'd point out is that you have to understand the history and
the way that the research was done in the past to really understand and appreciate this research. But it certainly stands on its own merit. Now, the first thing I draw your attention to, Tristan, is you're really talking about the subjective, qualitative aspect of the readings that were done. And the main focus of her research was on the much more, it still is subjective, but the measure of matching the person to the readings. Let me back up, if I can, and try and untangle this in a way that folks might understand. Here was her basic research protocol. She selected a medium, and she actually tested a bunch of mediums to see whether they were good mediums and they could really read the dead, okay? And then she found her group of mediums that she thought passed a certain test. Then what she did...
Can we have a little bit of information on that certain test? I think that's a key point here, is that if she's already determined that these mediums are people that she believes can talk to the dead and that they've passed this test, I think the details of that test are also very important, because obviously if we're working... That there assumes from the very beginning there that talking to the dead is possible and these mediums are able to do it. So that that first study actually influences what's going on in this study, because there's a weight of expectation and a weight of bias already sort of coming in, a momentum coming in.
I'm not sure I agree with you. I mean, I think if you really step back, first of all, the research hypothesis is not that everyone throughout the population is equally good at doing psychic medium communication. So there isn't any problem with saying, I want to find the individuals who are best at that. And then secondly, you know, since she's the one in this case claiming that these mediums are the best, I don't think anyone can really object to any criteria or any test she might have for deciding which ones are best. It's kind of like, you bring them and you tell us, you know, and it's just noteworthy to know that she's gone through some procedure of filtering these. And I would think as a skeptic, you'd be like, fine, I don't want you claiming at the end that these aren't your best mediums.
No. I mean, to be honest, I think for me, this is still key, because I think the process of filtration is incredibly important, because if involving this process of filtration, she isn't weeding out the people who actually can only speak to the dead, but is actually weeding out the people who are best accustomed to seeming able to talk to the dead. And for example, I know that mentalists such as Banachek and Ian Rowland and Darren Brown are incredibly skilled at pulling off the appearance of talking to the dead. Those type of people would be able to pass a test depending on the criteria she's put out. So if she's only, what she's weeding out isn't the people who can talk, or only the people who can talk to the dead, if what she's weeding out is the people who are best at appearing to talk to the dead, then that's obviously going to take a bias into the next study when we come to see whether people, other participants, are able to believe that these mediums are talking to the dead. Because if we're finding people who are incredibly skilled at pulling off the appearance of psychic skills, then obviously those very skilled people are going to be able to convince participants better.
Okay, well, I don't think it's a problem, but I think that where that issue really comes up are in the actual controls for the experiment. You have to make sure in the controls for the experiment that you're not allowing that to occur. Let me say this two ways. One, I think the controls that she uses in selecting those mediums are the same controls that she uses in the experiment, and the controls that she uses in the experiment are really the gold standard for this kind of work and are highly, highly controlled. I mean, they're triple blind protocols that, as we talk about them, I think most people would feel very comfortable with. So I hear your point on that. I welcome you to go and look at the criteria she uses for having certified mediums that pass some certain criteria. And if you still have your doubts, I guess we could bring that up later. But then let's move back into the actual protocol that she uses in the experiment. And I want to get back to Tristan's point on, because I think Tristan was focused on this secondary qualitative measure of, gee, how good did you feel about that reading kind of thing. And that's really secondary to her research. The main focus of her research and the main design was to do this. One, so she has her mediums. Then she needs people who are going to receive a reading. Now, we should note that she is completely blinded from the people who are going to receive the reading. There's another researcher that deals with the people who are going to receive the reading. Julie has no interface with them, no knowledge of them whatsoever, just so there isn't any inadvertent leaking of information by her to the medium. So the second thing they do is they divide those folks up into pairs. The people who are receiving readings are paired up, if you will. Not in any physical way, but in terms of the experiment, they're paired up. Now, the medium then goes and does a reading for the first person. So, for example, we'd do the reading for Tristan. And whoever Tristan's trying to connect with. Tristan's trying to connect with a grandfather, let's say. So the medium would attempt to connect with Tristan's grandfather and bring back all this information. And then next, the medium would do a reading for Gavin. And the reading for Gavin would be to connect with Gavin's grandfather, and they'd do the reading. So these are independent readings. And we have to say, during these readings, Tristan would not have any contact with the medium.
Would the medium be aware that Tristan has a grandfather that she's trying to connect with, or would she be able to tell that the person that the participant is missing on the other side? Would she be the one who provides the relationship link? Would she be the one who identifies the deceased, or is she told speak to Tristan's grandfather?
No relationship link, only a name. And only the name of the sitter. So only Tristan is given. And further,
why does she need that name, Alex?
Well, let's leave that aside for a second.
But surely, if she's psychic, she should be able to tell.
That is a completely, no, it's not, Alex. Realize how unscientific.
Realize how unscientific
that statement is. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, if she's got psychic ability, why can't she connect? Why can't she garner that information from me if she's supposed to be connecting with me otherwise?
That is an appropriate research question, but it isn't a legitimate complaint of the given protocol. Here, hold on, let me say this. Here would be a legitimate complaint to say that the first name information is too revealing, and it could reveal name or socioeconomic background or all these things, which she's controlled for. But to merely say that the name. You know, why can't the psychic do it without the name? I don't think that is really gets to the issue of whether these protocols are, as you said, dubious at best.
But of course it does. Surely if she needs my name, where's the psychic connection there? Surely if she's going to be connecting with me just from my name, she'd be able to do it without knowing my name.
See, I must admit, Tristan, I disagree at this point. I think if the psychic is genuinely given not the name of the participant at any point, and all she is given, she has never met the participant, she's never given any detail, she just walks into a room and someone says Bob, and she can then do a full reading. If that was what was happening, then that's fine. Now, what I would like to point out, and I know, Alex, you keep mentioning that she's controlled for this. I think that's a key point here is, for an experiment, where's the control here? Where's the control scenario? Because that's what appears to be missing in this whole experiment.
Well, no,
is
I think
a scientific control, the null hypothesis. No, I mean literally.
We've already talked about some of the controls. The most important.
No, I don't mean a control as in a protocol. I mean literally the control, the null hypothesis. You know, the water when you're testing a placebo pill. You know, okay. Where's the placebo equivalent here? Where's the if this is a top quality study, what you need is you need a control in place, and that control is that because the psychic is given the name Bob, which might well be Tristan's grandfather, and she might be given the name Jim, who's Gav's grandfather. She's also given the name, you know, Peter, who's nobody's grandfather. And if she comes up with a reading then there's the control having exposed a flaw in the methodology. Because if she's given a name that doesn't relate to anyone because of the control being that there's nobody attached to that name, if she then comes up with a reading, then we can see here that there's a flaw allowing in the methodology. So this is one of the reasons a scientific control is absolutely vital when we come to this, because then we don't presuppose that there is somebody there to talk to. We take a step back and we analyze whether that connection is taking place.
Right.
I agree. I thought that was really what was missing in this experiment, a genuine
not,
control.
It's not. Marsh, I don't know if you guys have read this experiment. Now I was getting to the next point. So we have these two readings, right? One is the reading for Gavin and one is the reading for Tristan. And then these readings are kind of sanitized to take out any name information that might be revealing of, you know, who the reading was for. Then each participant, Tristan in this case, would be given the two readings, the transcripts of the two readings with all the name information taken out. And then Tristan would be asked to select which is the reading that matches the person that they were trying to connect with. Now, to your point, Marsh, that is the reading that is not for Tristan's grandfather is the control. Okay, and then Gavin.
No, it's not. If I'm able to draw a comparison with a full scientific test, for example, let's say a drug company is bringing out two particular drugs to fight headaches. You don't compare the two drugs against each other. You compare the two drugs with a placebo pill that doesn't fight headaches.
Well,
and that's what's missing here. What you're doing you're comparing one company's drug to another company's drug. But if neither of them work, then they both work as none as each other. You know, if you need to find something that doesn't work to be able to compare it as a base.
I don't think you're correct on that. It's a perfectly okay to say that one of the readings that I've given you is an incorrect reading. It isn't for the person you've tried to connect with, and that is the control. So
it's okay to say that, but it's not. We've got to be very, very clear about the scientific terminology here. That isn't a control because it's not isolating the effect out. A control has to be an unrelated event in the research, an unrelated stream of the research that doesn't have what you're testing for involved, that isolates out the test, the particular criteria you're going for. So when it comes to drugs, you give them something that doesn't have a pain-killing effect, and that way you can test whether the other things do have pain-killing effects. In this scenario, what you need is something that doesn't have a psychic effect to test whether there is a psychic effect. What you need is an unconnected name that wouldn't have a deceased person attached to it. So if she's reading this name, then and believing that it could be for someone involved in the study, then that there allows you to figure out whether she's genuinely connecting with someone or whether the medium, and I don't know why I'm saying she, the hypothetical asexual medium is actually connecting with someone or whether that medium is just fleshing things out through other means. You need that scientific control, and I'm being very specific about the terminology. You need that scientific control aside.
I think you're completely wrong about experiments of this kind, social science experiments of, you know, if we're doing survey work of the same kind, I think these methods are completely appropriate and in line and better than most kinds of experiments that are done of this kind. So we can leave that aside as an issue where we just disagree.
Well, I'd like to just make one last little point on that. When it comes to psychological studies, because the human psychology is so wondrously complex, that actually doesn't mean that a control is less important. It actually means that you need a more specific control. And if you read a well-designed psychological experiment, you always have the group of participants who, instead of doing X particular activity that you're testing for, just does crossword puzzles or sits in a room doing nothing, because you need that base number to take from, because you can't just read human psychology because it's so wondrously complex. So you do. I think for me, this whole study is fundamentally undermined at a very, very fundamental level by the lack of a control. I mean, we can continue talking about other elements of the methodology and talk about the flaws elsewhere. But for me, the fundamental flaw that is insurmountable and means this study would not pass a rigorous peer review is very much that it doesn't have a control. So it's not comparing against a null hypothesis. It's just comparing against a positive hypothesis. It's talking about degrees of positivity rather than positive versus zero. And with this unfalsifiable nature to the study, it fundamentally undermines everything in the research. But we can, so long as we've got that point set out, I'll park that as being my major issue that for me undermines this whole study. And then we can talk about other elements of methodology, but I just wanted to make that point very, very clear that this is for me where this study completely falls down, and everything else on top of this after this is just icing, basically.
Okay, so let me just say in as clear terms as possible, I think you're completely wrong, and I think that by the standards of any study of this type in this general area of the social sciences, these are completely appropriate control means. And I think that your analogy of this kind of method with drug company controls, I think, is inappropriate for this experiment. And I think if you want to hang your hat on that, which you have, I think that's great. And I commend you for sticking your nose out there and really saying something. What I'm going to do is follow up with this, and I'm going to get an interview with someone who really understands not this particular research, but this kind of research. And we're going to go over these research methods, and we're going to present evidence as to whether or not that very strong statement that you made really holds up to scrutiny. So I commit to doing that.
Absolutely.
And then with that, I think we can leave it on. But I would add one thing is that I think that, you know, when we get into science and scientific methodology and research methodology, a lot of times we can leave people in the weeds, and they don't have to be left in the weeds, because my experience is that this stuff usually comes back to common sense, in that the kind of methods, kind of controls, kind of protocols that really work invariably come back to common sense. Now, I think in this case, common sense would dictate that if you received two readings, and you had to pick which reading, and these readings were edited for any kind of name information, that's a pretty fair 50-50 proposition in terms of your likelihood of picking
the reading. But it's 50-50 fair. 50-50, you've got a chance of getting it right by sheer chance alone.
Right. So what is
for me, because of the idea of mediumship, so I'll just make one slight point. Because the idea of mediumship for me, because I from the evidence I've seen, I don't believe that you're able to contact the dead. I think what's actually happening more often than not is cold reading, which we know is a form of magic tricks. We know that there are mentalists, there are magicians who specialize in cold reading. And I think the equivalent scenario here, the common sense scenario, is if a magician is doing two magic tricks in front of you, and you know, magicians have been able to guess your card, and you're trying to decide which of them read your mind to find the card out. Well, no, because they're both magicians, and they both have their methods of doing card tricks. What you need is someone who's never done a card trick in his life, and if they're able to guess your card, then you can get that mind reading is happening. If they're not able, then you can put it down to the fact that this is a magic trick.
Okay, but Marshall, let's take
sorry,
that.
Sorry, can I put in?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Regarding controls again, why not include a control? Even if you don't believe it's vital to the study, it'll shut some skeptics up.
No, but Gavin,
it would shut me up, definitely.
Gavin, I would submit to you that there is a control, and here is the control. In our case, Gavin, when we talked about connecting with your grandfather, if we provide you with two readings, and one reading is an accurate reading, was really for your grandfather, and one wasn't, well, then the one that wasn't is the control in this experiment. You're not just being asked straight up just to qualitatively measure whether this reading is good or bad. That would lack control, because then you'd be saying, well, compared to what? Yeah, that made me feel good, but compared to what? In this case, you're getting two readings. One's the control reading that isn't for you, and one's the reading that is for you, and you're asked to pick which one do you think best matches the person you were trying to connect with. So once we're past that, then we have to look at the data, and you said it's a 50-50 chance. It is. It's a 50-50 chance. What her study showed, her triple-blind, peer-reviewed study showed, is that 13 out of the 16 of those 50-50 chances were correct. Well, that's a hugely statistically significant number for this kind of experiment. And it's very...
Well, you can toss it.
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, Alex, I was just going to say, you can toss a coin, you know, 20 times, you can get it to come out 11, 12 times heads in a row.
Great. What are the odds of that, Tristan? What are the odds that you'd achieve 13 out of, let's say you're going to flip a coin, what are the odds that you'd get 13 out of 16 heads?
Well, it's a 50-50 chance every time.
Well, but there's combinatorial statistics that would tell us exactly what the percentage of what the probability is that you would achieve 13 out of 16.
But each time you toss the coin, you're a 50-50 chance again.
But I don't know what I don't think the two what you're saying and what I'm saying are at odds. I mean, this is basic statistics. You could do this kind of stuff all day long, and that would be a meaningful result. If you were able to say that I was able to affect something that is supposed to happen 50% of the time, and I was able to affect it so that it happened 13 out of 16 times to come a certain way, that would be evidence that you are generating some kind of effect along the lines that you're talking about.
Okay, you're right. Obviously, you know, as you do go on, it's 50-50 chance each time. But as you say, it will actually change. You know, well, it won't change, but over time you will expect, you know, to throw another one, so which will be a tails. But again, each time you're a 50-50 chance.
I don't think that's it. I mean, I think it's all to do with the level of what counts. Because we have this scoring system.
Perhaps I'm missing the point here, yeah.
What's happening here? We have this 1-6 scoring system that the readers are being asked to score their individual readings on.
Let me interject here, Mark, just so everyone's clear. We are not talking about the 1-6 right now. Because the way the research protocol was this, that at the end of the reading, folks were asked forced choice, right? You have to go one way or you have to go another way. You have to pick which reading.
Oh, I see. Sorry. I wasn't aware that it was a forced choice. Okay. So the readers had to determine that one of their readings described them as an outcome. That was one of the things they had to do. It wasn't that they could only have to pick the one that they genuinely felt was about them. They just had to pick one of them. The lesson. So, I mean, what you're doing, what you're saying here is that the results didn't take out the section of lesser of two evils kind of thing. You know, the rock and a hard place scenario where you've got to choose one of them.
Correct.
And you're forced. I mean, if you're actually looking at a scenario where people are asked genuinely, "Do you think this describes you?" That's a very different question from "Which of these do you think describes you?"
And that's why,
which I think is very important.
Well, there's so many questions here, research questions that are very important. And that's why I think it's important to really tear these things apart, number one. But number two, look at the history of these experiments. Because one of the things that Gavin interjected about putting in an extra level of control just to shut skeptics up. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. And I think that – let me qualify this. I think this is part of the history of this experiment. And I think it's part of the history of this experiment that sometimes makes it hard for this experiment to really understand and penetrate. Because what they've done is they've added so many levels of control, and they've gotten so far down this path of just trying to isolate any example of anomalous communication that they invariably wind up with the criticism that I think both Tristan, you and Marsh were kind of going to, which like, well, what's the big deal? Well, what the big deal is that all the accounts by thousands of people of highly significant, meaningful, transformative experiences that they had with mediums. So what the researchers did is said, hey, forget all that. Let's try and boil this down to something that is as simple as it can be, a coin flip thing. And let's see if we can make that coin flip in our direction as much as possible. So in looking in that full context, I think is really important to understanding maybe why they've taken some of the soul, if you will, out of what is really a very significant experience for a lot of folks, and that is a reading and a connection with, you know, someone who's deceased.
I used to go to spiritualist church, Alex, okay? And I had two readings in the course of a month, and in one of them I was told that both of my grandparents are dead. Okay, on my father's side, and they're both alive. And in the second reading, I was told that my grandfather on my father's side was dead and that my grandmother was alive, but that she also lived in the States. And neither of those two readings was accurate in any way or form. So why is it justified that I would have to choose between the two?
Well, I think there's two separate points there. One, your personal experience is interesting, and it obviously informs your current belief about whether communication with the dead is at all possible. So I understand where you're coming from personally. But what we're doing here is kind of stepping outside of that and saying, let's look at a particular experiment and how that experiment was done. And in particular, we're kind of putting you on the spot, Tristan, and making you defend a statement that said that the protocols and the means that they had for testing this were dubious. And I don't think they are dubious. Now, to answer your other claim is, why don't they do it this way or why don't they do it that way? Those are, you know, suggestions we can have for future research. But when you really look at the effort that's involved to put a study like this together and the amount of time and the amount of work that goes into it, we have to kind of take with a grain of salt any kind of future suggestions folks could have for how it could be done differently. In particular, why it was a forced choice was, again, I think, was to bring things down to as simple of an experiment as possible in terms of, again, identifying anomalous communication. They're not answering the question of where do spirits go or how do loved ones connect with folks from the beyond. All these questions that we have that are really interesting. They really tried to simplify it down to one simple question. Is anomalous communication possible?
But the research won't answer that if both the readings you're actually receiving aren't controlled. Again, we could be receiving things, you know, which are fictional. And if we're obliged to choose between the two of them, then, you know, you could go into a supermarket and you could buy two eggs and you could get them home and you could crack them both open and you could find they're both rotten.
I don't really know exactly where you're going with that, because, again, I mean, basic scientific kind of theory would suggest that if you have something that is a 50-50 proposition, let's say, for example, in this case, let's say the medium was ineffective, you know, just didn't know what they were doing, were out of their head, was me, who have no psychic ability at all. And I was given this name. I was said, given name, okay, here, Alex, here's Tristan. You know, go ahead and type out your reading. And I, okay, you know, I'll do my best. And then I was given, okay, here's the next name, Gavin, type out your reading. And I did that. Well, what are the chances that if I did that 16 times, what are the chances that the folks who would receive those readings would accurately pick it 13 out of 16? Well, the odds are a straight probability, because what should really happen is, because I don't have any psychic abilities, if I were to do those readings, you'd expect chance results. You'd expect 50-50, 50% of the time I'd be right, 50% of the time that I'd be wrong. So when we don't achieve those results, we have something that's highly suggestive that there is an effect there being measured.
I think what this study actually suggests is that, I mean, for a start, you've got to look at the fact that there are 16 participants, which is an incredibly low number. I mean, what you've got to bear in mind is that if this study were true, and I'm going to leave apart the previous issues that I've had with it and give it the benefit of the doubt for a moment and say, okay, we believe that the results of this show that 13 out of 16 people in perfectly blinded conditions, which I'm not 100% sure they are, but I'm going to go with it, in perfectly blinded conditions, 13 out of 16 people chose the reading that was intended for them, whether they believed it was genuinely brilliant about them or, you know, when forced to choose between in a 50-50 choice, chose that was intended for them. The 16 people here. Now, you've got to bear in mind, if I wrote A and B on two pieces of paper and put them in envelopes and asked 16 people to choose the A without showing them, if 13 people were able to choose the A, I wouldn't say that those people were psychic. I would just say we need a larger group, because chance, as Tristan was pointing out earlier, the longer you go on, the more impressive the 50-50 chance becomes. If you weren't choosing between binary here, if you had 20 mediums giving 20 readings and 13 out of 16 people picked their reading out of 20, that's a more impressive result because the data set is much wider, the variance is much wider. But when you're given 13 out of 16 people giving a 50-50 choice, getting it correct, isn't really that impressive. It's like kind of saying, you know, if one person was given a 50-50 choice and they got it correct, we wouldn't take that as a decent data set because they had to either get it right or wrong. 13 isn't a large enough... because it's all about bearing in mind the ramifications of what this result would mean.
I was with you right up until you said that, which is outside... the realm of even what we're talking about. So let me back up and unwind and respond to a couple of things you're saying. Would we like a larger sample size? Certainly. Again, we have to look at the context of the research, the history of the research that has preceded it, and the research that has followed it. It's difficult, time-consuming, expensive to do this kind of research. The funding for it is very limited. None of those are excuses. They're just realities. So this is one study that we're looking at and we're focusing on. There have been subsequent studies by the Winbridge Institute since then. Some of them are in publication at various phases. There's also been studies that have been done before this. All of them are highly suggestive of the same conclusion. To your point of whether or not we'd like to see a larger sample, of course, everyone would. But let's go back and rewind to the question that we were really trying to answer. I was challenging Tristan's post when he said that the research protocols are dubious. They are not dubious. And I think his word, if I went and looked it up, were highly dubious. They are certainly not. They are very, very good controls for an experiment of this time. I would again assert that they're really the gold standard of controls that you would want for this kind of study.
Well, we've established they're not the gold standard because the gold standard very, very specifically would be involving...
No, we haven't established that. We're leaving that alone because that's your point. I don't think it's going to stand up.
Well, if we're leaving it alone, then you also. If we're leaving it alone, then you can't call this a gold standard because
agree,
that's the point we've conceded. But no, what this actually and this is the important thing for me. If we're going to forward the results of this study, this 13 out of 16 people as being significant, you have to bear in mind that if this result were proved true, we can't pin this one result on being proof of the paranormal because it's only 13 out of 16 people. Now, if this was proof that people were able to, you know, tell which channel the TV was on when they were blindfolded, things that we know we can do, you know, by hearing it, things like that, then that's a mundane thing. You know, that's a mundane event that happens to us all the time. We're able to do that. But this, what the ramifications of this result, if you're believing this result are true, are that there is something inside the human body which survives death, that something is able to maintain a consciousness beyond death, that consciousness is able to retain a memory of its previous life, that consciousness with memory is able to get back in contact with its previous loved ones via the use of a medium and transmit information. Now, 13 people getting a 50% chance out of 16 people isn't enough for us to start believing that all of those scenarios have happened. We have to use Occam's razor here and say that there is a chance element here. And while a chance might well be small, it might only, I think I worked it out to be round about a 2 or 3% chance, something like that. I'm not a mathematician, but I was just throwing the numbers around there on a piece of paper while we were talking. That chance is small, but it's still a bigger chance than everything else we've suggested. So the only way to settle this towards the positive hypothesis that you are talking to the dead is to introduce a third party as a genuine control and to do this experiment with not 16 people, but with 160 or 1,600 or 16,000. And if we're still getting far, far, far higher than chance results, then we can start thinking that something anomalous is going on here. But 13 out of 16 people isn't enough to prove something genuinely extraordinary. I mean, extraordinary in the most literal sense of being otherworldly, out of this world, beyond all logical and scientific conclusions thus far. We need a lot stronger before we can start believing these results. And we need to tighten up the protocol before these results can mean anything.
Thank you, Marsh. You expressed yourself far more eloquently than I did then when I was talking about coin tossing. You made the point that I was trying to make.
Yeah, because your point didn't make any sense.
No, I very rarely make any sense. I'm used to talking complete and utter rubbish. That's what I do in the days.
Well, I was worried that we were going to spend the entire time talking about this experiment, and I think Marsh has given us a perfect launching off point on another topic that I feel very strongly about, and you're dancing around the phrase, extraordinary claims need extraordinary proof. And it's something that I've folks on who listen to the Skeptico show will be tired of me hearing me say this, but it's a completely ridiculous notion, pardon me, and it's incredibly unscientific. And I just had this dialogue with Richard Wiseman and Rupert Sheldrick, who were on Skeptico on a live debate. And the problem with it is that I think this original quote came from Carl Sagan, and I'm sure he was referring to the general public. You know, how we generally perceive the world, we require extraordinary evidence for extraordinary claims. Now, when we move into the scientific realm, we have specifically gone a different direction, because the problem with extraordinary is that it's subjective. So we would always have this means.
No. It's not subjective as a scientific term, because the ordinary is the perceived.
We designed a system in science called peer review. And the whole idea of peer review is to answer just exactly that question. What are extraordinary claims? What are extraordinary proof? And as the evidence mounts, then folks move and form opinions one way or another. But the individual claims that are being made go through the normal scientific process. Scientists are always asking, is this claim extraordinary? Is this proof extraordinary? It's part of the process. So to pull out and then at a meta level claim that one particular study should be thrown out because, or should not be considered, or is not evidence of something, I think misses the point. In the argument you were making about whether this 13 out of 16 should allow us to believe all the things that you were saying, no. The only thing we can ever say about any study is it highly suggestive of establishing the research hypothesis? So there's two things there, and then I'll shut up. One is that what is this particular study suggestive that we can believe the research hypothesis? That's all we can answer. And number two, the only thing we can say it's either evidence for or evidence against is the research hypothesis. So stretching it out and saying, well, it would therefore mean this. No, it only means what it says it means.
Okay. Well, I think I see what you're saying there, and I think it is a good point worth making. And I think I'd almost completely agree with what you're saying, although I'd say there is a third option for what this study could mean. And this study needs to be conducted again with larger numbers, because this study, the statistical significance isn't high enough to make this study worthy or usable as indicative of the research hypothesis. So if this were a phenomenally rigorous study with plenty of with a large enough data set and that scientific control that I just can't get out of the corner of my eye, then it would be a study which was in a better and more robust position to be indicative of showing a positive result for the research hypothesis. Because the study is too small and because the statistical significance isn't high enough, and that statistical significance has to be worked again, and this is where the extraordinary claim comes in. That statistical significance is what is statistically significant depending on the claim it's making. You know, if this was statistical significance of me being able to tell which brand of toothpaste was on a particular brush, 13 out of 16 would
difference.
Be quite high.
Now, hold on. I was with you. I was agreeing with you right up until the end.
Now, of course it would.
Let me back in and move off of this topic, because I want to leave it aside the same way that we left the last one, because, again, I appreciate and really respect your willingness to kind of stick your nose out there and say, you just said something. Let me make sure I got it right so that I'm not putting words in your mouth. But you said that the sample size and the level of significance of the results are not meaningful in a way that would be suggestive of the research hypothesis. That is something else when I get my expert on, and hopefully it'll be an expert that you'll agree is truly independent. I'm just going to go to Amazon and find somebody who's written a book on this. It's no one I know it right now. But we'll see how this stacks up in terms of effect size for this kind of study. And again, I think you'll be, I don't think what you're saying is going to hold up. I think this is appropriate. I think the peer review was appropriate. And I think that the study will be, I think that's what we'll have people say.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I disagree, because I for me it's because it's a 50-50 choice. It's the same as lining up 16 people, having them all toss a coin and call the coin while it's in the air, and if 13 of them get it right and 3 of them get it wrong, that's not me saying that. That's not enough, that one experiment, to say that people can guess what type of whether the coin will land heads or tails, and that's exactly what's happened here. This is exactly the same scenario.
Well, there's two different things to pull apart. One is in the larger context. Would you want to see if such an experiment is repeatable? Of course. And that's why I again refer back to the larger history of the experiments that have done before and after that replicate the result and show that they're pointing in the same direction. But then all we can do when we have one particular study is look at that particular study and say whether that study adds credence to the research hypothesis. I'm saying, yeah, it certainly does. That if you can run this study and you get 13 out of 16, then that goes in the favorable pile over there in a pretty significant way. So,
well, it goes in the favorable pile, but not in a significant way. It goes in the favorable, but more study needed to reach a firm conclusion. There's nothing about this study that's conclusive because the numbers are too small. It could be seen as a starting point for further research, but this can't be taken as indicative of the human being's ability to contact the dead and the human being's ability to survive death and contact the living. Because 16 people guessing a 50-50 chance, 13 people out of 16 guessing a 50-50 chance isn't enough to be convincing of something, well, of anything, but specifically for me, of something this extraordinary. I mean, I could let it slide if it was something mundane, but you've got to sort of see it
seesaw. There's no reason to let anything slide. I mean, let's get off this a little bit, because I'm glad we can put something under the microscope and tear it apart, but we have to look at the larger context, because you've touched on it a couple times. The real scientific question underneath all this is survival of consciousness. Really, it's even deeper than that. It's the nature of consciousness. It's is our mind, is our conscious experience, is the me that makes me, is that purely a function of my brain, or is there something else? And then the question related to that that we're all interested in is that me, does it survive after I die? And I'm going to suggest that what we've been talking about is just one of the lines of evidence that are highly suggestive of the assertion that your consciousness does seem to survive your death in a way that we don't fully understand, and we all can admit we don't understand it, but the evidence is overwhelming.
You can't say from this study that the evidence is overwhelming.
Let's talk about the near-death experience research. I just had on, who is now a New York Times best-selling author, Dr. Jeffrey Long. He's just published probably the most comprehensive analysis of near-death experience work. He's a medical doctor. He's a radiologist. He's reviewed over 1,000 cases, very carefully done research, highly, highly suggestive of what dozens and dozens of research papers over the last 20 years have asserted, and that's that consciousness seems to survive death in some way that we don't understand. And I would also put that research down besides any skeptical research to the contrary. And we've had those folks on Skeptico. So pick who you like. You like Dr. Susan Blackmore? Had her on. It doesn't make any sense. You like Dr. Michael Persinger from Canada? Had him on. Competent researcher. Really smart guy. His counter hypothesis doesn't hold up to scrutiny. You like Kevin Nelson at the University of Kentucky, REM intrusion? Had him on. Had somebody on to directly refute his claims. The latest the best, the most comprehensive research on near-death experience is highly suggestive of this hypothesis.
Well, I'm sorry. That's actually something that it's an area that I haven't done an awful lot of looking into. And all we'd be doing, essentially, if we had that debate, is having a proxy argument from authority, essentially, where you cite the people from your side and we cite people from the more scientific side that of
cite them, please.
What I'm saying is that debate isn't really worth having because neither of us are experts in these fields. Neither I presume you could well be. I don't know. I'm certainly not an expert in near-death experiences.
No, that is that's fine. The first part of what you're saying that you're not well versed in this. And therefore, you know, you don't want to have it. But to suggest that both sides of this would be an argument by proxy of our selected authorities, I disagree. I just told you, I listed all the people that I know of who are on the other side of the debate. So if you have those other people, then bring them on. But I'm listing folks from both sides of the debate in terms of this issue. But if it's not something that you feel comfortable talking about, let's not do it. One other thing
We
run out of time that is also relates to this consciousness issue is something that we got into last time. And the reason I like to bring it up is because, again, it gets back down to the science. And I guess my criticism of some of the skeptical science is that it violates all the good principles that skeptics generally kind of tout about critical thinking, careful analysis, and proper controls and all those things. And I'd again point to the Global Consciousness Project, the work done by Dr. Roger Nelson with the cooperation of Dr. Dean Radin. Nelson was formerly at Princeton University, and now he's retired, and he's amassed a tremendous database. Last time when we had our discussion, we brought up some points, and I think you guys were just misinformed on how that experiment is really done. And I'm wondering if you have any kind of follow-up thoughts, if you've looked into that research, and if you have any follow-up thoughts that would explain the phenomena they seem to be seeing there.
We have looked into it. Tristan, do you want to go with this? I mean, I've only got one real sort of strong point on that.
I've got a big question to ask. Okay, I look at the amount of electronic equipment that uses binary. Why are only the eggs affected by global consciousness? Because we're talking about an experiment here with random number generators, which are just spitting out binary, aren't they? Perhaps I miscorrect. Am I right there, Alex?
Well, I think your question, you want to, why are, we don't know. If your question is, why are only the random number generators in this experiment being affected
consciousness? Yeah. Well,
yeah, not eggs as in like hen's eggs or chicken's eggs. Tristan's not that crazy just yet.
Halfway there. The
acronym they use is EGG for the random number generator. And we should point out that what this random number generator is, and I think this answers your question, Tristan.
Yeah.
What the random number generator is a little device that exhibits the quantum tunneling effect. So at a quantum level, we have a pretty good handle that that quantum events are truly random in every way that we can measure them. So we can devise this little piece of hardware that demonstrates quantum tunneling, and then from that spits out a series of ones and zeros, which we can be completely confident is truly random. So that's what they're measuring. They're not measuring, for example, the ones and zeros, if you want, of some data stream that comes out of your computer. They're measuring the specific quantum effect from this little device that they attach to the serial port of these computers.
Absolutely. And that quantum effect is, as you say, truly random. But you're saying that the at significant times, and I know Tristan might have something on significant times in a moment, but at significant times of significant world events, those random factors, those random quantum events go from being 50-50, you know, in terms of split between a positive and negative, or, you know, a plus and a zero, a one and a zero. It goes from being 50-50 to, I believe, it ranges between 49 is statistically significant on one side, or 51. So if the probability switches from being a genuine 50-50 split to up by 1% or down by 1%, then that's considered to be the statistical effect of the global consciousness. Is that a fair summary?
No, not really. The effect. I think you were right up to a point. Just the specifics here are really important. And I'd back up and maybe, as we did before, give folks a more broader picture of this. So Dr. Roger Nelson, he's at the University of Princeton. He's measuring all these different kind of anomalous effects with random number generators. So he has these little random number generators. He takes them to meditation class and he says, hey, does the stream change from what you're saying? You know, does it go one way or another when all people are chanting together? He takes them to sporting events. Does this little egg that he has, does it change? You know, he has people sit and stare at it and try with their intention to focus it and to make it go one way or another. And all those experiments that he did for years and years and years at Pair in Princeton are well documented and chronicled, and some of them were successful and some of them weren't successful. But at the end of the day, they came away feeling that the research and the data was highly suggestive that in some way people could affect these random number generators. So then they devised another experiment. They said, okay, what if we created a network of these random number generators and spread them all out over the world and then measured whether or not these kind of global events that happen, whether those have any effect on our global consciousness, since global consciousness is a term that's kind of in our modern vocabulary, and we all kind of think we know what that means and if there is such a thing. So what they decided to do was measure things, both things that couldn't be predicted, like earthquakes or terrorist attacks, but also things that could be predicted in advance, like New Year's Day or the opening ceremonies of the World Cup. So they really have both kinds of data in there. So one of the criticisms you'll hear that is completely unwarranted is that this is just a data mining exercise, that they go and they collect all this data and then they sift through it and look for the results. Well, obviously they don't, because as I just told you, they don't only look at retrospectively, but they look prospectively at events. So that kind of eliminates that possibility. But back to your point, Marsh, and where I was, I guess, correcting a little bit your interpretation of it, is what they're really measuring is the coherence of all the random number generators together. So they're not measuring statistically whether one random number generator goes a little bit out of being random, but whether the group as a whole of 60 random number generators are in coherence or are not in coherence at specific times. And the way they've done that is with a very sophisticated means of statistical analysis. All their data has been published. All their data is publicly available. And all the work has been analyzed by numerous people. And no one has really found any fault in it that I'm aware of. Now, one of the things that I've participated in and currently participating in is a collaboration between Dr. Roger Nelson and Dr. Chris French at the University of London and some of his associates to look at this and get their skeptical take on it. But I have to tell you, at this point, the researchers at the Global Consciousness Project have been around for a long time, and they've taken on all comers, and no one's knocked them off the king of the hill. And for that, we all need to tip our hats to them and say, that's what we have to accept what they're saying until someone can say why we shouldn't. And I think their research is certainly of a high enough quality that we should do that. And that's the follow-on discussion that I wanted to have from last time, because again, the drive-by is, oh, it's nothing, it's data mining, oh, it's fringe science, it's pseudoscience, whatever the claims are. Dig into the research and show me where the problem is.
Have we got a control in this experiment?
Yes.
Could you explain the control for me, please, Alex? So I was looking at May and Spotter's word, their paper about the 9/11 attacks, and I noticed, I think it was there, one of the things they raised. It may have been May and Spotter's word, it might actually have been Brian Dunning from Skeptoid, about lack of controls.
I guess it's a valid point to always bring up, but in this case, there is just no problem with controls. You have billions and billions of pieces of data. So you can go in and sample any part of that data, and what you would expect to find is randomness. And if you find randomness in all the places, you know, if you keep sampling it, you keep finding randomness, and you keep that, well, that's your control. Your whole database outside of the events that are being measured is your control.
So
you understand what I'm saying?
So perhaps we could have, how many random number generators are there? Is it 64?
Something like that.
Yeah. So could we have another group of 64 and compare them?
Why would you have the network. You have 64. What I'm saying is that any time, like right now, is a control minute. Okay, for the 40 hour and 4 minutes we've been talking is a control. You know, there aren't any planes crashing into any buildings, at least that we know of. There aren't any earthquakes. There aren't any other natural disasters. So assuming that there aren't any earth-shattering events going on, this last hour that we've been talking is a control. It should generate randomness. If it does, then that's and if you were able to continually do that and sample different times and they always came up random, well, that's your control. And that's a very, very strong control.
I understand where you're coming from, but surely where's the harm in having, you know, maybe splitting those 64 eggs and 50-50 split? Have one of them as a study group, and one is a control group, and the other is a trial group.
Great, do it. Do it. All the data's there. You can slice it and dice it however you want. Take half of them and do that.
I'm actually thinking of two separate groups, so separately.
They're all independent, so there really isn't any need to separate. You can separate and slice and dice however you like.
What is the statistical variance? And how far is it outside of two standard deviations of the statistical mean?
It's huge.
What are the numbers?
5 or 6 sigma, if I remember correctly. It's in the order of odds against chance of millions and millions to one. They've done now over 200 events they've measured, and the cumulative odds that those events would have the kind of coherence and vary in the way that they did, that do, the odds against chance, off the top of my head, I could be a little bit off, are something in the order of 20 million to 1.
Oh, so what are we defining as coherence, Alex? When we have an event, are we saying that the eggs will start to throw out and random numbers at exactly the precise time something occurs, or is there a window either side?
There's a window. And as we get into that, I mean, all that is published and available and anyone can look at it. And if that's the order of that, you know, somebody wants to go down and check, certainly able to do it. But, you know, again, I think it's been combed over pretty good. And they've looked, they've been the most critical of themselves, as far as I can tell. They've generated the most interesting observations about how to tighten their work and how to move those windows around. But now that you understand what's really going on, you can see that it's quite a robust database to ask just those kinds of questions. If you can get past the amount of data that they've amassed and how convincing it is, and then what's really impressive to me are the follow-on research topics that they've tried to tackle. And one is space related. So, you know, they say, okay, so if the World Cup ceremony is being held in Johannesburg, so we're going to say beforehand, which they already have, that that's going to be an event that's going to create a global coherence. Well, then the next question that they're looking to ask down the road is, well, what is the spatial properties of that global consciousness effect? Does it affect more some of the random number generators that are closer to the area in question? Does it move out in some way? Is it time dependent? Is there any time variance? All this.
What's their hypothesis in terms of spatial sort of connection? Which one do they hypothesize is the most likely to be changed?
Well, their preliminary work suggests that there is a spatial relationship and that there isn't, that they can detect, a temporal relationship. So there is some pattern in terms of space and the proximity to the event. There doesn't seem to be anything that they can measure in terms of time related to the event. But that's preliminary. But again, to get there, you have to kind of accept the body of what they're saying.
So they're hypothesizing a particular area is going to experience an effect, or are they going to, you know, see which area is affected on the day. I just want to know whether they're... Because one of the fundamental things about a scientific method is that it can be make predictions which can be shown to be true. So I just genuinely interested to see where they believe their random numbers will be most affected by the World Cup finals.
Well, again, two things. One is they're very careful not to offer any theories. They're just observing a phenomena in the best way that they can. It's a very interesting and important phenomena, and that's just darn good science, and that's the way science is done. We don't always have theories for explaining phenomena before we can observe the phenomena. So they're doing a great service just by trying to isolate this phenomena. And to the second point that you made, you know, their hypothesis, or, you know, do they have something testable? Well, yeah, I mean, they have 200 events that they've recorded beforehand and then analyzed with methods that they already had in place, and there are their results for anyone to see.
How is the replicability of the experiments
going?
Well,
again, have
been any of the groups able to replicate this?
Well, they've done it 200 times. Are you saying No, sorry.
Different groups. Because obviously, one of the fundamental things about a surprising result is that you want people who aren't the initial proposers of the result to be able to discover the same results. That's one of the ways that you iron out any potential flaws, not just through looking at the methodology of it, but also by looking at whether other groups are able to replicate the studies. Because where groups can't replicate the studies, that sometimes can be a clue that something isn't quite perfect in the methodology.
Well, there's two ways.
So are there other groups working on it?
There's two parts of that we can look at. One is, has anyone else replicated creating a worldwide network of random number generators? And no, they haven't. And I'm sure that those folks would welcome someone doing that. It's just a very ambitious undertaking, and no one's done it. That's certainly can't fault them for that. Secondly, has anyone else used their database and done their own independent analysis and arrived at similar kind of conclusions? And in that, the answer is definitely yes, and it's well documented on their site of several folks who have done that and have actually taken other events. Peter Benzel in France is a gentleman who came to the project as very, very skeptical of it and was interested in looking at a number of different events, and what he chose were earthquakes. And he looked at a very interesting phenomena. He compared the earthquakes that happened under the sea with earthquakes that happened above ground. And you can read for yourself the results that he found. But it's very interesting, and the important point is that at the end of the day, he became very convinced in the accuracy or the reliability of the research, and he's really a true believer, if we can throw that term into the mix.
Well, what I can say is, with Chris French and his team working on it, I certainly look forward to seeing their results of it. I mean, as you can probably tell from the second half of this conversation, I'm not as familiar and as on track with looking at things like the GCP as I am with looking at psychic readings. I mean, certainly psychic readings are where my area of interest and expertise tend to lie. So as you can probably tell from the second half, I've had a lot more to say in that area. So I think the best we can really do as our group is to await Chris French's expert findings much as anything else and see where those guys go with it.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
We'll follow up. We'll make sure we follow up either by email or by another chat like this. But I think it's the ongoing give and take that really has the chance of shifting what we think.
Yes, I agree. Cool. Well, thanks very much for that.
Yeah, cheers, Alex.
Okay, thanks for that.
Guys.
It was interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Take care of yourself. Bye.
Thanks again to Tristan and Gavin and Marsh for joining me today on Skeptico. You know, I did not do the follow-up that we talked about in the interview because I think as time went on, I got the sense that it really wasn't necessary. We kind of resolved some of those things. But we'll see if there are any issues to really follow up in terms of some of the questions that Marsh had about experimental controls. Happy to do that, but I think most of those are put to bed. And happy to follow up with these guys as well. Enjoyed chatting with them. Well, that's going to do it for today. I have a couple of interesting interviews coming up in the future in Skeptico. In the meantime, be sure to check out the Skeptico website, skeptiko.com. There's a link to our forum there and also a link where you can just post a comment right on the website. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.